Can You Dig It? With Dr. Craig Barker.
Let's check in with what's been happening in the world of archaeology. Welcome back, Craig.
G'day, Rihanna. How are you?
I am well. And are you getting over your jet lag after coming back from your dig site in Cyprus?
Well, yes, I am. But given I've got a 20-month-old son at home, I mean, who needs sleep anyway?
That's true.
But no, all going well, and we're in the process of writing up our results from the work we did in Cyprus throughout October. So it's a quite exciting time for the project.
Well, Craig, a new exhibition in London under the Bloomberg building is now open. What is this?
Look, this is a really great story because it's about one of the most significant Roman-British excavations of all time. And this is at the Temple of Mithras, or the Mithraeum. Mithras, the bull slayer, was a mystery cult, an Eastern mystery cult from the eastern provinces of the Roman Empire. And there was a temple built and dedicated to the god in London, of all places. So again, shows you the real multicultural nature of Romano Britain. It would have been built in about 240 AD and became one of the most significant religious structures in ancient Roman London. The site itself was actually excavated in 1954 by the Museum of London. And Molar, the archaeological services that's run out of there. And bear in mind, of course, in the early 1950s, there were, you know, this is not long after the Blitz and not long after World War II. So there were large building sites right across central London that were damaged or destroyed. So during the process of actually attempting to build a new building right in the very heart of London's financial zone, they came across this temple site, and it became a major archaeological investigation at the time. In the very last hours of the dig, they found a marble head of the god, and so that actually proved the theory that it was dedicated to Mithras. Became a major media sensation at the time. The British Prime Minister at the time, Winston Churchill, actually forced the developers reconsider. Originally, the foundations of the new 1950s building was going to go right for the very heart of the building, and fortunately, because of Churchill and the government's insistence, they ended up building around it. But at the time then, what happened was they built a very, very poor substitute replica Mithraeum around the corner, which became very quickly one of London's most unloved and unvisited tourist attractions and very, very much forgotten. Aww. So it's kind of nice. In the 21st century, the real one has been revealed. It's been very carefully re-excavated over the past few years. It's been very carefully restored. And if you go into Bloomberg's building that it's just opened this most recent month in the very, very heart of London's financial heart, 7 metres below the city street, you can actually go and visit the site. And apparently it comes with an amazing soundscape too, where you actually get the impression of sort of, you know, sandaled feet shuffling along and chants in Latin, of an initiation ceremony.
When it comes to the world's oldest depictions of dogs located in Saudi Arabia, Craig, you've got some news on that.
Yes, people wondering how long dogs have been domesticated.
Exactly.
Well, more importantly, not even necessarily how long dogs have been domesticated, but at what stage did we humans begin actually depicting artistic representations of our best friends? And so what's quite extraordinary is a project that's being led out of the Max Planck Institute for the Science of Human History, based in Jena in Germany, has been doing survey of a hilly region in the northwestern area of Saudi Arabia, in the middle of the desert, because the period we're talking about, it would have been much more fertile. This is in an area known as the Sawamis region, and they have catalogued more than 1,400 rock art panels containing over 7,000 different types of humans and animals, including at two different sites, at Sawamis itself, around about 150 representations of dogs, and at a nearby site, around about 190 depictions of dogs. And in most cases, what's happening is these dogs are actually alongside hunters, you know, archers with bows and arrows that are hunting scenes, and you've actually got the dogs impact with them. So it's not just a representation of dogs, or not a representation, not necessarily a representation of wild dogs, but deliberately indicating that they were domesticated. And indeed, in the case of at least one of them, it looks like the dog is on a lead. So it's basically, and where the story gets very exciting is that, and again, we've talked about this many times in the past, the difficulty with dating rock art, and there are all sorts of issues, but the project is pretty confident that the rock engravings that they've been able to identify are around about 8,000 years old. So what you've got is, if they are accurate, it predates the previously known depiction of dogs, which is on pottery from Iran, by several hundred years. And so basically you're now looking at a tradition of art or artistic depictions of dogs that's now over 8,000 years. And basically from these lovely etchings of dogs on leads helping their masters hunt, right through to dogs playing poker and dogs playing billiards.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. But on a more serious note, what's lovely is that the dogs actually look quite like what are described nowadays as the Canaan dog, which is largely a feral breed which roams around the desert in the Middle East. So it's kind of interesting that we possibly can even identify the species of dog.
I love it. Anything to do with that where animals are depicted. In, you know, whether that's, you know, art on walls or, you know, on, you know, vessels that are painted or whatever. But I always like, you know, just seeing kind of a little glimpse of maybe what they were used for or their relationship. And obviously, you know, I'm totally into cats, so.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, look, it's also that fantastic relationship between humans and domesticated animals as well.
Yeah.
So that realization that you know, in particularly arid and difficult climates like you know, this part of Saudi Arabia, which is, again, not as dry as it is today, 8,000 years ago, but certainly still would have been quite an arid area, that we become dependent upon these animals that we domesticate in order to survive, in order to thrive. And so it's lovely actually seeing them represented as part of that scene. But the idea of the lead, and it's interesting because it's difficult to tell if it is actually a lead. Paul Takon, a very, very well-known and well-regarded rock art specialist based here in Australia, has actually suggested in an article that, or you know, in a response to the article, rather, that it may be something of a symbolic connection, a bond between the animal and the dog, rather than a true lead. But whichever interpretation is correct, the important thing is that relationship between humans and other animals.
I'm Rhianna Patrick. This is ABC Radio and Dr. Craig Barker is in for Can You Dig It? And we're taking a look at the moment at what's been making news in, you know, what the latest archaeological news is actually. Now, Craig, there's been, some have called this a spectacular discovery, but is it a griffin warrior in Greece?
Well, no, the tomb that this particular object was found in, it was actually found in May 2015. So it's a lovely example of the archaeological process, that it's not what, you know, it's not necessarily what we find and recognise in the ground immediately, but often it takes months, years, even decades in some occasions in order to actually evaluate and to establish some sort of identity of the material culture that's being researched as well, and actually appreciate what stories it may be telling. So this is from a place in southwestern Greece called Pylos. Those of our listeners who are great fans of Homer and you know, the Homeric epics, the Iliad and the Odyssey, of course, will know Pylos very well. It's where Nestor came from. But it's an ancient grave which has been identified, or it's been called by the excavators from the University of Cincinnati, the grave of the griffin warrior. And this is because there is actually a depiction of a griffin that was found in the grave. Now, the burial itself took place around about 1450 BC. So if the Trojan War did actually happen in the way that Homer described it, what you're looking at is a burial which is probably, you know, at least 200 years older than the Homeric era. And it's actually quite a significant time in terms of the history of Greece, because you've got the Minoan culture thriving and, you know, incredibly prosperous on the island of Crete, but on the mainland, which is where Pylos is located, relatively little signs of sophisticated culture and interconnectedness. Within a few generations of the finding of this tomb, you will, of course, get the development of the Mycenaean culture based around the Mycenaean citadels, the great city-states of Mycenae, Pylos itself, and so on. So it's quite a pivotal moment of transformation. And what you're getting is a lot of wealth coming into mainland Greece from the island of Crete. And so this particular object that, as I said before, was found by the University of Cincinnati team, led by Jack Davis and by Sharon Stoker, very, very well-regarded archaeologists. But during the excavation, in amongst all the gold and the other bits and pieces that they found, which seemed to show clear influence of material coming from Crete to mainland Greece, was found a large bead. And it was quite, encrusted with dirt and with grime. And so, kind of got ignored during the actual initial excavations because of all the focus on all the other rich finds that were being done. As the conservation team set to work this year, actually removing the lime that had covered the bead's face, slowly what revealed was an agate stone, gemstone, that was engraved with a design. And this design is really, we're talking absolutely microscopic. It's a very, very tiny, tiny piece. But they've published in the journal Hesperia this month representations of this gemstone and of the carving. And I must say the photos don't do justice to it, but if you look at the line drawings that have been published, and the New York Times has a fantastic story if anyone wants to follow up on it, but it actually replicates this line drawing. It's a beautiful, beautiful, stunning depiction of a warrior in battle with two others, one of whom has fallen and is lying dead. The other one is in the process of being killed by our main warrior. Two things really stand out about it. The first one is it's so small. It's incredibly small, very, very difficult to see for the naked eye. So what you're looking at is somebody who's engraved this stone, who has incredibly good eyesight, to be honest. And indeed, one of the theories that's been put forward, which I must say I personally don't buy into very much, but that potentially the engraver was nearsighted. The other option is that that the engraver might have needed a magnifying glass, which is extraordinary because we're talking about, over 3,500 years ago, almost 3,500 years ago, someone on the island of Crete is shaping glass in such a way that they can actually magnify to allow this incredibly skilled artisan to carve into stone this depiction of a battle scene, which is extraordinary. The other thing about it, again, for those of us trained in the archaeology of Greece, is that the way that the human figures are depicted in the scene is actually not typical of what you see in Minoan art at that time frame.
Really?
It's very, very... Minoan figures, particularly in gold and other jewellery of this size and this scale, this miniature representation, are often very abstract and very stylized. Whereas in this case, you've kind of got a sense of what you would see in classical Greek art with, very, very contrapposto, the human body is fully formed and fully three-dimensional. So it's extraordinarily beautiful, extraordinarily detailed, and nothing else like it to date in the history of Minoan art. So since it's been published, literally the various internet groups that I'm involved in or that I belong to, and the email groups and so on that would probably bore most of our listeners, but they've gone crazy in discussing this particular piece. So it will be studied and studied and studied for years to come, but it is a masterpiece of miniature art from the Aegean Bronze Age. And as I say, although it's earlier than the Homeric epics, it's so invocative of, Achilles and all of those legends as well, too, that one can't help but be drawn into this era of the late Bronze Age in the Aegean world.
Dr. Craig Barker from the University of Sydney is in for Can You Dig It? And we're currently taking a look at what's been making archaeological news this month. And, Craig, the discovery of some grape residue on pottery has thrown up maybe the oldest evidence of winemaking?
That's correct. Now, we've spoken about wine a lot in this segment over the years, haven't we?
We have. I mean, it is... Look,
I'm not
it
sure
is,
what that says about us. But
it is one of your trivia questions, I feel. It is something that you are interested in. So it doesn't surprise me, but it does surprise me that... Is it Georgia where this residue was found?
Yes. So we're looking in Georgia in the Caucasian region. And I must say that it's rather interesting. The media's picked up on this a lot because of recent publications, but it's been speculated that Georgia was a significant early centre of wine production for quite some time. So it's kind of nice to have scientific and archaeological verification of this theory. But up until quite recently, the oldest direct chemical evidence dating wine was over 7,000 years ago in northern Iran, in a series of six vessels found in the Zagros Mountains back in the 1960s, back in 1968. They underwent chemical residue analysis back in the 90s, from memory. Again, they've been dated to about 7,000 years ago. There's always been this sort of push to push it back further and push it back further and push it back further. So for quite some time, Georgia's kind of put its head up, but it's only now that we have confirmation. I should also point out that the Chinese earlier this year, and I think we might have even spoken about it for memory, but there was a suggestion that at one stage the Chinese held the record, although you could argue whether or not it's actually wine. It was probably more likely it was a type of beer, fermented beer, rather than wine. So it seems to be Georgia holds the record now, and this is from a series of pottery fragments and one restored vase from the Neolithic period, found in two archaeological sites in two villages south of the capital of Georgia, south of Tbilisi, about 50 k's south. The project is a multinational project, but it's involved Professor Patrick McGovern from the University of Pennsylvania. I'm a massive fan of his work, in large part because of what he's been doing in terms of looking at the relationship between domesticated grapes and human history. I had the privilege a number of years ago. He actually worked with a couple of local Pennsylvanian brewers to actually develop some modern beers that were based on ancient recipes. So I had the privilege of actually being at the launch of that. When was that? About 2012. So, yeah, really remarkable area of research in terms of the history of alcohol and consumption. But the project that he's involved in now really clearly, definitively proves that Georgia is the earliest evidence of wine, or certainly these vessels were holding grape, even if not necessarily wine. And what's even more extraordinary is that outside of the vases, there were kind of decorated blobs, which might be a very, very early abstract attempt at trying to actually depict grape clusters as well, too. So you've kind of got this relationship between functionality of the vessel and the decoration on it as well, which is extraordinary. So 30 pottery fragments analysed, 26 soil fragments analysed. What they found was that the pottery had incredibly high levels of tartaric acid, which is a substance found in grapes. So it suggests that at the very least the vases are being used to store grapes, but it's probably far more likely, given the shape and the size of the vases, that they were actually being used as giant wine storage containers.
And finally, Craig, a story which I know that Daniel Browning, the presenter of RN's Away, he was part of the convoy that took these remains back, but Mungo Man has gone home.
Yeah, look, this is such a lovely story, and it was so lovely to see the coverage of the repatriation of not just Mungo Man's bodies, but also more than 100 other human skeletal remains found from the Mungo region over the years as part of the whole convoy. And, of course, the ceremony was broadcast on ABC TV. I believe it's still online, actually. But a really, really moving ceremony. And I think in many ways a lovely circular story of not just Mungo Man himself returning to country, but also the way that ever since his discovery in 1974, the way that Australians think about our own history and our own long human occupation in this continent. The discovery of Mungo Man in 1974 really revolutionised the way that Australians thought about our history. It was very, very significant historically in terms of the development towards reconciliation and the recognition of white Australia, of Aboriginal Australia, having this long connection with land. And what's lovely is to actually see the human skeletal remains, which have since the 70s been stored both in the Australian National University, more recently in the National Museum of Australia down in Canberra, actually returned to country. And so you kind of have this, it's kind of interesting because for many years there was almost like this conflict between the call for repatriations and the reburial of humans that have been excavated from various places around Australia. And the call from not all, but from some people within the white scientific community sort of saying, no, it prevents us from doing more analysis and more research, and had we not had the chance to actually date Mungo Man, that pivotal date of proving that Mungo Man was at least 40,000 years old, having such a significant, profound impact upon Australian history and historical thought. And I think that what we now see in the 21st century is that it doesn't need to be either or, that through collaboration, archaeologist and community working side by side, we can collectively learn so much together. And there's all sorts of really profound changes and developments that have been going through. I'll just mention in passing that Dr. Christopher Wilson, who graduated from Flinders University last month in Adelaide, the first ever Indigenous Australian to gain a PhD in archaeology. This is part of the evolution, that it's no longer us white scientists talking about the history of Aboriginal Australia, but actually us working together, community, scientific knowledge, and I think that Mungo Man, just on a purely symbolic level, besides all of the importance of what he represented, is such an important story. And I think that more and more Australians need to know about Mungo Man, about the story of Mungo Man, about Lake Mungo, the site itself. It's such a remarkable place. But associated with it, of course, and associated with all of the lovely stories that came out about the Hearst and the fact that he was returned in a wooden coffin which featured wood that was over 8,000 years old. But there's been some nice profiles. The last remaining member of the team that discovered both him and Mungo Lady in the late 1960s, the other burial found, or the other cremation actually, found a few years earlier. But Jim Bowler, the geologist on the site, who's now 87, but the last surviving member of that initial project, really lovely interview with him in The Guardian. And again, something that he says in the context of that interview, that, old Mungo Man, he's 36,000 years older than Abraham would have been. And that type of storytelling really, I think, is something that we all need to know as Australians about our long history.
And Craig, what is happening at the Dutch National Museum of Antiquities until March next year?
Yeah, a couple of interesting exhibitions opening in various places around the world. If anyone is passing through Holland before March next year, an exhibition called Nineveh, Heart of an Ancient Empire. And it's one of the largest exhibitions ever in mainland Europe. The British Museum did have a major Nineveh exhibition a few years ago. But in terms of a European museum, more than 250 objects from both Dutch and international museums, including the BM and including the Louvre, all from the Assyrian capital of Nineveh, in modern Iraq. Around 700 BC, it was not just the capital of the Assyrian Empire, but indeed the largest city on earth. And of course, it's been very badly damaged in more recent years because of activities by ISIS and the entire struggle over the past few years. So, again, museums being able to actually capture these places that are in the news and actually provide some sort of historical context. So it's a really, really interesting sounding exhibition.
Tutankhamun's gold sheets go on display for the first time ever.
Yes. So this is now a really interesting story here. The most famous archaeological discovery of all time.
Mm-hmm.
Tutankhamun. We all know Howard Carter.
How it ended. The curse. The dog.
The curse. Yep. And so on. Yeah. So who would have thought that in amongst the material that was found by Howard Carter, there were not just items, but gold items that have sat in the basement of the Cairo Museum for over 90 years and have never been on public display before.
No.
So as of last week, a series of golden sheets from Tutankhamun's tomb displayed in the Cairo Museum, the Egyptian Museum in Cairo. The project's partially financed by the German Foreign Office. You've had teams of German expert conservators actually going through some of the objects. Now, bearing in mind that over 5,000 objects were found in the tomb, it is understandable not everything got catalogued at the time by Howard Carter's team, but it is still amazing that it's taken this long for these objects, you know, gold objects, to have actually been properly studied. And what you're looking at is automated gold sheet and leather appliques that were probably associated with the chariots that were buried within the tomb, possibly parts of quivers and blinkers and chariot coverings as well. I mean, they're incredibly delicate, in some cases very badly preserved, but the project of bringing them out of storage, conserving, restoring, and putting them on display is remarkable. So anyone passing through Cairo can actually go and see items from Tutankhamun's tomb that no one has seen before. And at the end of December, they're actually going to be moved to the Grand Egyptian Museum to be displayed as part of the Tutankhamun collection when it opens in the new year. And I think we should do a segment next year when it opens, because it's going to revolutionise the way that Egyptology is presented to the world, that new Grand Egyptian Museum.
Wow. Something a little bit closer to home, Craig, in Australia, Dirk Hartog's plate is on display in Launceston.
That's right, yes. Now, I think it may have just finished today, unfortunately, but if the exhibition is still on, the people of Tasmania still have a few more days to pop over to the Queen Victoria Gallery. On loan from Holland, the oldest known European object ever found in Australia, which, of course, was the plate that Dirk Hartog hammered to a post in 1616 on the west coast of Australia.
And finally, Craig, this is one that I'm extremely excited about. Mammoth action at mammoths. The Australian Museum in Sydney. 42,000-year-old baby mammoth is on display. I watched the unboxing of it on Twitter.
Ah,
I got
fabulous.
Really excited about it. And I think I'm going to be in Sydney at the same time that it's on. So I know where I'm heading when I'm on holidays.
Yes. Oh, brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. Well, it opened earlier this week on the 18th of November. It's the exhibition called Mammoths, Giants of the Ice Age, really an exploration of megafauna and also that relationship of human interaction with animals of this size as well. But, as you say, the 40,000-year-old woolly mammoth, Leube, I hope the pronunciation's right. I'm not very good on Siberian dialects.
Or maybe baby woolly mammoth names.
Baby woolly mammoth names. But discovered in 2007, there is a fascinating story behind it that the local reindeer hunter and his sons who found it ducked back into the village to notify authorities, and when they went back to the site discovered that one of their cousins, I believe, had actually dug it out by themselves and had taken it to the butchers and left it out the front of the store, and part of the woolly mammoth's leg has actually been eaten by dogs from the village as well.
That's awful.
It's not pleasant, but a very clear indication in terms of why excavations must be done properly, scientifically, and well away from local dogs and so on. More seriously, I mean, of course, the fact that with global change and climate change, that what you're getting is that a lot of the tundra and the permafrost that is actually holding a lot of these animals, a lot of these specimens from the Ice Age, frozen, are, of course, retreating. And we're seeing with glaciers retreating, all sorts of objects turning up from all sorts of periods of human and natural history as well. So it's also quite sobering from that perspective, that whilst it's incredible to have this glimpse into, the deep, deep past, we really shouldn't be as well. So I think it will be quite an amazing exhibition from covering that. I've not had a chance to see it yet myself, but I've quite a few of my friends and colleagues have already, and say it's a remarkable exhibition.
Well, Craig, put it on your list.
I will get there.